on your mobile, on your wavelength. Talk Radio and Talk TV.
Good morning and welcome to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk TV. We are very near the end of yet another week. We've got some startling information to share with you today. And first of all, shall we just offer our commiserations to the family and very good friends of John Motson, who was, of course, the voice of football, mostly at the BBC for about 50 years. Some younger people listening to this probably won't remember him, but he was an iconic figure, a man whose voice can be heard commentating over some of the most important events in football over the course of the last five decades. So we'll be treating him with some respect throughout this show. We'll be hearing from various people who knew him, who worked with him, people in the business. We'll be talking to some people from TalkSport on that as well. Coming up though first, we've got Isabel Oakeshott, TalkTV's international editor. We've got lots to talk to her about. There's been a shooting in Northern Ireland which has come at a rather bad time, and it looks like paramilitaries have shot an off-duty police officer. Rishi Sunak is pledging to fix the migrant system by basically fast-tracking loads of asylum seekers into this country. Doesn't exactly sound like he's fixing anything, does it? Meanwhile, we've got some immigration results which prove that numbers have risen by 60% in 1 year alone in terms of the people coming on the boats from across the channel. And the boats are getting bigger as well. It used to be that the average number of people per boat was about seven. Now it's in the 20s. So we all know that things are going pretty badly wrong. Also this morning, Keir Starmer is going to set out his so-called five missions. I'm not sure I can wait. I'm hardly able to contain my excitement at the idea of Sir Keir Boring actually standing up and saying this is what we're going to do if we become the next government. By the looks of things, it's not going to be particularly groundbreaking. It's not going to be particularly exciting either. Also, we're going to be talking to Steve Lillywhite, the legendary Grammy award-winning producer of U2 later on. I want to find out from him what is going on inside Pink Floyd. You know, the album Dark Side of the Moon, one of the most iconic albums of all time. I think almost everybody's got a copy of it. I think it's been in the charts ever since it was released in 1973. There's a big feud going on between two of the members, Roger Waters and David Gilmour. We'll find out what that is all about. Ella Whelan is here with us today as well. We're also going to talk about the latest rules if you're a driver that are coming into a position in 2023. These are things you'll need to know about, because if you don't know about them, you'll be getting a fine. Marvellous, isn't it? More war on the motorist. Also, it is Thursday, of course, so we'll have Helena Nicklin here with the Thursday Club. Lots more of your calls to take as well. 0344 499 1000 is the number. We'll still find out as well why things are going so wrong at Lancashire Police. There's another investigation now going on into the visit that they made to Nicola Bulley's home just a couple of weeks before she disappeared. 0344 499 1000 is the number. This is Talk TV. I'm Mike Graham. It's the Independent Republic. Let's get it on. Welcome to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. Let's say a very good morning straight away to Isabel Oakeshott, TalkTV's international editor. Isabel, nice to see you so soon after last night.
Good morning. How are you today, Mike?
Yeah, very well indeed. We were on the talk last night, by the way, I should say, before anybody starts trying to make any sort of other assumptions. But very interesting news day today. Keir Starmer setting out his stall as what he would do if he became the next Prime Minister. So far, from what we've seen, it doesn't look particularly exciting, but you wouldn't really expect it to be. But I suppose the big story of the day today is going to be this fast tracking of 12,000 asylum seeker immigration applications, which seems to me to be a complete and utter betrayal of whatever it was that the Home Office was meant to be doing.
I mean, which genius in Number 10 and the Home Office thought that this plan was going to go down well with the British voters? Mm. I mean, it is an extraordinary capitulation, isn't it? An extraordinary expression of defeat that actually the method for dealing with this ludicrous backlog, which should never have built up to the scale it has, it's actually of historic proportions. A backlog of asylum seeker applications, 150,000, is higher even than it was under Labour in the late 90s. Yeah. So which genius thinks the way to deal with this is just to wave 12,000 plus of these people in? And you know, the 12,000 figure is not at all representative, I don't think, because under the system, those 12,000 will be allowed to bring in so-called close family members.
Right.
And I think we'll soon find that on average, those individuals bring in four or five other people. Mm. And I'm not so naive, and I don't think voters are, as to imagine that this, if this proves a convenient way for the Home Office to say, look, we've tackled the backlog here, they won't extend the criteria for qualifying for the quick release scheme, because that's what it is, to an awful lot more of those applicants.
Yes, I mean, it seems also ludicrous that they're going to be giving them a questionnaire. I mean, this is more what I would regard as sort of civil service working from home speak, isn't it? You know, we don't want to actually go and see anybody. We don't want to look at them face to face to see what they look like or how they speak or what their demeanour is. We'll send them an application, which will no doubt be filled in by one of those charities who will show them all how to fill in the application to make sure you get a tick. And they'll all be let in. There won't be any question of them being denied asylum because they'll know how to fill out the form.
Well, of course, that's exactly how you would game the system. I don't think there can possibly be any substitute for looking these individuals in the eye, taking an overall common sense assessment, using some judgment as to whether this person really has a legitimate claim. Because ultimately, you know, anyone can tick a box saying, I fear I'm going to be persecuted for my religious beliefs or sexual orientation, or whatever. You and I can tick those boxes too. It's no substitute for sitting face to face with someone who actually has the power to use their discretion and their common sense to assess whether this individual is telling the truth or not.
Yeah, I mean, there is simply no substitute for that, as you say. And also 12,000, considering that we've now got figures which have literally just come in this morning, just being read through now. Total in 2022, 60% higher than in 2021, when there were 28,526. 45,755 people were detected arriving by small boats last year. So together with those two figures, you're looking at sort of 75,000 people. They're fast-tracking 12,000. Now, I can do the maths. It looks like there's still quite a few left over.
I mean, it is astonishing when you think that, you know, a Conservative Party is supposed to care and be competent in relation to our national security and the integrity of our borders, and that this government and successive Conservative administrations have been left in no doubt about how strongly voters feel about this issue. I mean, it was one of the main drivers for the Brexit vote. How could any Conservative MP, never mind cabinet minister, be in any doubt about how much this matters to people? And yet they seem to be either unwilling or incapable of actually doing what it takes to sort it out. Yeah. And I think that voters and our viewers on Talk are feeling extremely frustrated about this, because they don't for a minute believe that Labour would be much better. You know, we all know from talking to Labour MPs, they talk a good game, don't they, about how they'd be more competent. But their default position is actually to let more people in. Yeah. It just is. Right. You know, most of them didn't want to leave the EU anyway and are still labouring under the misapprehension that leaving the EU actually led to a reduction in the number of people coming into this country. It didn't. Mm. We have a million more people than we did. So I think our listeners and viewers just wonder where on earth to turn. Who is it that's going to actually grip this problem? Who can they vote for that will do that?
Well, this is it. I mean, all we've heard from Labour is that they would set up, dispensing centres and places where people could make applications in other countries. But I mean, all we know from that historical kind of precedent is that if you fail to get your application through legally, you'll come illegally. And that's what they've been doing. I mean, one of the interesting stats from these immigration stats this morning is that there are an average of 41 people per boat in 2022. But back in the previous years, there were 13 people per boat or 11 people per boat. In 2018, only 7 people per boat. So the boats are getting bigger. The operation is getting more professional. It's a money-making concern. The human traffickers are now millionaires. They're never going to stop. They make too much money.
You know, I'll tell you, I'm only interested in processing centres if they happen to be on the Falkland Islands.
Yeah, right.
You know? I mean, we've got plenty of overseas territories that could be pretty useful in this task. I mean, Australia had no compunction about establishing a processing centre literally thousands of kilometres away. So, look, I think we've got to be very, very focused on solutions that work. And solutions that don't work are those that just deal with the problem, like commissioning a load more hotels at taxpayers' expense. People should be in no doubt as they face rising taxes, with more to come just within a couple of weeks' time when Jeremy Hunt unveils his doubtless utterly dismal and business-destroying budget. That the money that goes out when you see your wage slip and you see the chunk that has gone, part of that is going to pay for hotels for asylum seekers. It just is.
Yeah, exactly right. I mean, as far as this new plan for 12,000 to be fast-tracked, they might as well just fast-track them now and just give them citizenship, you know, because, you know, the questionnaire process is just going to be a sham. You might as well just say yes, tick to all of them and let them all in. But that's not what people want. People are really, really worked up about this. We've seen what happened in Liverpool. I'm sure that's going to start happening in a lot of other towns and cities, because people are sick to the back teeth of having immigrants filling hotels in their cities.
And we don't. And the real thing is, we don't also know who these people are.
No.
How much do they wish us well, or are they at best neutral about their what contribution they can make to this country?
Yeah.
And if they, let's hope very much that they don't have any criminal intentions. But that's not really good enough, is it? Just to be, you know, just to be somebody who's going to, at the very least, not fall foul of the law.
Yeah.
If we're going to bring people in, which I'm absolutely not against per se, I think it's about who we're bringing in, not about, not about shutting everything down.
Right.
I think we want to bring in people who can make a positive contribution to our country. For that, they have to, first of all, be able to speak the language, or at the very least be willing to learn the language. They have to have some skills to offer, and they have to be committed to contributing to the broader society, giving something back to the country that rescued them from their persecution.
And also, it would be quite nice, would it not, to know what contribution they've made to their own country before they left it. Because if they've, you know, murdered somebody or stolen things or been involved in some kind of, you know, drug smuggling operation, then no, thank you very much indeed. But stay where you are, Isabel. Isabel Oakeshott's with us, TalkTV's international editor. We'll continue looking at these statistics that have come in fresh off the presses just right now this morning in the last hour. Immigration statistics which show that once again, this government is not tackling in any way, shape or form the numbers of people coming to this country. They don't know who they are, they don't know how many of them there are, they don't know what they've done, and they don't know how many more are coming. Apart from that, it's going really, really well. This is Talk TV.
Online, on DAB+, Talk Radio and Talk TV.
Welcome back to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. Coming up, Ali McCoist is going to join us, former Scotland and Rangers star, of course, also from TalkSport Breakfast. He's going to be joining us to talk to us about his appreciations of John Motson, who passed away, the news just breaking this morning, 77 years of age, a legend of the sporting world, a legend of the BBC, actually, but unfortunately let go later on in his career by the BBC. But a man that commentated on some of the most iconic moments, of course, of the entire world of football. Isabel, I'm sure that you're not going to be too familiar with the football commentary business, but it's a very sad day. We'll be appreciating John Motson. And one of the things about these kinds of stories when they happen, for me, is that you can look back at different times and see what it was like. You can remember, you know, 1966 and the World Cup and, you know, the missed penalties and Gary Lineker and all of the kind of the times when, when England and the whole football business was a very different business. It wasn't owned by Qataris and fabulously wealthy billionaire Americans.
Yes, I mean, Mike, you're right in your assumption that this is not going to be a moment for some expert Oakeshott commentary. All I would say is that even I had heard of him. I appreciate that he was an absolutely legendary figure in that business. And I imagine that there'll be lots of really interesting trends coming in.
Yes, there will. Let's turn our attention to Northern Ireland. We were talking about it the other day because of obviously what Rishi Sunak is also up to in that region of politics. You know, his promises to try and get Brexit done after Boris Johnson left it slightly undone are still very vague and nobody's quite sure what's going on. But the shooting last night is rather badly timed, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very unfortunate timing indeed. I mean, there's no good time for an outrage like that. But Northern Ireland is an extraordinarily sensitive issue for Downing Street this week. I think that they have misjudged quite badly the strength of feeling within their own party about the integrity of the Brexit deal and the importance that Northern Ireland isn't somehow treated as a third country. You know, it's part of the UK, and any Brexit deal needs to entirely reflect the fact that the whole of the UK has, at least in theory, left the EU. And Rishi Sunak is facing, you know, an almighty rebellion and potentially the loss of some senior government figures if he screws this up badly, which he appeared to be on course to do. Well, so there's been a pause in Downing Street and they are trying to figure out how to get this right.
Yes. And I mean, is there a way? Is it one of those situations that's impossible to get it right? There is no way. I mean, the Sunday Times wrote a leader on, at the weekend, which I found quite appalling, actually, saying that basically, regardless of whatever the outcome is, there has to be a deal, even if nobody likes it. I'm not sure that's necessarily what the British public are expecting.
I mean, it is proving a lot more complicated than I think a lot of Brexiteers hoped. And that is partly because the EU, as is their wont, is very determined to make it as complicated as possible. I mean, you can't have a situation. I mean, imagine if you were driving from London to Cornwall, and as you entered Cornwall, you had to work out whether to go into a green lane or a red lane. You know, that is what has been proposed for Northern Ireland. I mean, look, this is all pretty daft. You know, I'm not sure what it is that's the enormous divergence in the standard of goods produced that there needs to be so much anxiety about the EU regulations there. And it's unbelievable that so many years after leaving the EU, there's still so much argument about this.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't seem to have a solution, really, at the moment. And I mean, I don't really know whether Rishi Sunak has a clue about what he's going to try and get from the EU.
The thing I struggle to get my head around as well is the implications of how difficult this has proven to be for Scottish nationalism. Because if we can't sort out with the EU arrangements with the Northern Ireland border, how on earth does Scotland think that they can, the Scottish nationalists that is, think that they can rejoin the EU but leave the UK?
Yeah.
I'm just baffled by that. What kind of Scottish border arrangements would there be? And aren't they looking at what's going on in Northern Ireland and thinking, hang on, this is like a fundamental flaw in our madcap idea?
Yes, I mean, you might think all of that would be true, but who can say? Isabel, great to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed. Isabel Oakeshott, Talk TV's international editor, who can be found on all sorts of other programmes throughout the network at all times. Right now, though, I'm delighted to say I'm joined by Ali McCoy. Ali, how nice to see you.
Nice to see you, mate.
Thanks for popping in. I'm very well.
It's
very well indeed. Sad news this morning about John Motson. 77 is not much of an age these days, but I mean, what a man. I was just watching some of the... even with the sound down, some of the kind of, you know, just incredible moments of football that he commentated on. And the numbers of stats that I've seen in front of me, 2,000 games, including 29 FA Cup finals, 10 World Cups.
Wow.
I mean, nobody's done it like that, have they?
Mate, it's see me say it like that. Absolutely remarkable.
Mm.
I'm very, very fortunate. I grew up listening to him. I was very, very fortunate to work with him.
Yes.
And then I've been sitting about the house when my kids have been playing these football games and I can hear them upstairs coming out my bedroom.
Yes.
So,
because he was more than just the voice of BBC television, wasn't he? He
of course
became the voice of all kinds of games as well.
100%. 100%. You know, he's synonymous with football growing up from people like myself of that generation. And also, I think it's, you know, I tell you what's amazing. And I was just saying when I just finished our own show there, Mike, remarkable. I actually showed my boys, my two younger ones, a bit of footage and a bit of commentary from John in a Hereford Newcastle game back in, I think it was 1970, whenever it was. And I wanted to show them, A, the goal, B, the quality of the park, and C...
It was like a mud bath.
Exactly, and C, listening to Motty talking.
Yeah. And that was one of his kind of claims to fame, wasn't it? Because apparently he was sent to do that game and it was just meant to be one of the sort of afterthoughts at the end of Match of the Day. And then it became this amazing game, 100%. This iconic sort of cup tie.
Just shows you never know the moment.
Yeah.
You know, you never know the moment. But what I was saying, with our own, TalkSport's own commentator, Sam Matterface,
yes,
on, and obviously Sam looked up to Demotti and was one of his heroes growing up. And I was talking to Sam about that and it was amazing with somebody like John Motson, right? It wouldn't have mattered whether it was Brazil in the World Cup final, as you say, did 10 of them.
Right.
Or whether it was Stevenage versus Barnet.
He was still there with
He was still there. He was still as enthusiastic. That sheepskin coat was there. Really sad news.
Yeah. Incredible as well to see the way that football has changed when you watch some of the footage, yeah. as you say, not just from the point of view of the pitches and all of that, but I was saying just even to a Oak shot there, you know, now we've got, you know, Qataris and people that live in Monaco buying football clubs. We've got the Premier League making an absolute fortune, a record number of millions of pounds spent. I mean, it's completely transformed, isn't it?
He's lived all through that.
Yeah.
You think about it, as you rightly say, back to the 60s with those mud baths football, yeah. he's come through the revolution, the Premier League, Qataris buying football clubs. Mm. You know, he's actually covered the whole cycle mm. of football in the last 40
And when
40,
you worked with
years.
Him, was that at TalkSport? You came to TalkSport for a
yeah,
bit, didn't
both,
you?
Yeah, both. Well, before, and indeed at TalkSport. And just a breath of fresh air. Yeah. Always great value, mate. Always great value. Always the story. And once you heard that voice, you always listened.
You did. Absolutely brilliant. Ali, you back tomorrow morning?
Tomorrow morning off,
yes.
mate.
Oh, you got tomorrow morning off?
Yes,
okay.
Don't tell Andy.
Normally, he's on breakfast, gets up very early in the morning and works with Alan Brazil, which is a chore in itself. Well, see, we never know whether he's going to turn up at all, do we? Ali McCoy, thank you very
Thanks,
much.
Mate.
Legend of in his own lifetime as well, of course. John Motson, as we said, died this morning at the age of 77. Sad news, we'll be appreciating his work and his life all the way through this show. This is Talk TV.
Fast talk. Street talk. Mike Graham. Fighting the good fight with all his might. Providing a welcome dose of common sense for the common people. Solid talk. Hot talk.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham.
On your mobile, on your wavelength, Talk Radio and Talk TV.
Welcome back to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk TV. It's a sad day for the world of football. We'll be speaking to Gary Newbon, MBE, coming up very shortly. John Motson has passed away. The voice of football, a legendary figure, described as by Gary Lineker as a brilliant commentator and the voice of football, a man who did so much for the game, for the broadcasting business as well. He managed to commentate on 29 FA Cup finals, 10 World Cups and 10 European Championships. Absolutely extraordinary stuff. We'll be talking about that with Gary very shortly. Also, Ella Whelan is here, Spike's columnist. She's going to be telling us all about Lady Susan. Remember the woman who was forced out of Buckingham Palace, Lady Susan Hussey? She's now back at Buckingham Palace. She's been rehired, apparently. She was spotted going back through the staff entrance working for Princess Anne. She was involved in that kind of racism row between a charity worker and an event that was hosted by the Queen Consort, Camilla. We'll find out more about that story. Also, we'll find out the latest from Lancashire Police, who are now facing three investigations over the handling of the Nicola Bully case. We'll also ask Ella what she makes of Keir Starmer's speech, in which he set out his five missions, none of which, apparently, are going to involve any kind of policy on immigration of any kind. 0144 499. What am I talking about? I've given up the wrong number. Anyway, we'll come back to that. 0344 499 1000 is the number. There's so many numbers in my head that I've sometimes given out the wrong one, but that is the right one, and that's what you should do. Let's talk, though, first of all, to Gary Newbon, MBE, television sports personality, of course, and presenter formerly with Sky and with TalkSport as well, a friend of John Motson's. Gary, very good morning to you.
Good morning. It's a sad morning, and as you say, the world of sport will be in this country will be mourning Motty. It was a great commentator.
I mean, so many people in the game, former players, former commentators, current commentators. I mean, everybody knew John Motson's voice. I mean, we had Ali McCoyston this morning. He said as soon as you heard the voice, you knew it was him.
Yeah, well, I've known that voice since we were 11. We were in the same year at boarding school at Colford School near Bury St Edmunds.
Yeah.
The Methodist school, his father was a Methodist minister in the Docklands, so Motty got a free place there. So we have kept in touch and we've worked for rival channels. He was at BBC, I was at ITV for 36 years and 14 years with Sky Sports, and as you say, 10 years or whatever it was with TalkSport. But we kept in touch, and although there were great rivals, the BBC and ITV in those days of the World Cups, both sides knew that we were at school together, and we had one day where we went off for a boozy lunch every World Cup, yeah. and we worked on many of them.
Yes, well, he worked on 10 World Cups, which is an extraordinary number, 10 European Championships, 29 yeah. FA Cup finals. And it was hard to imagine, really. And Ali was saying as well, it's even sort of beyond that football commentating job that he had. His kids would suddenly go on to, I presume it was one of the FIFA games, and you'd hear his voice on that as well.
Yes, he was, like myself, really, a bit of a workaholic, although When he left TalkSport, he decided to retire and went into a bit of a recluse mode, really. I only spoke to him occasionally, but before that, we'd kept in touch. So many stories from our school days as well. I mean, my grandmother from Leicester used to send me the sports paper in those days. We had sports papers. Yes. To, we were boarders, and I was the only one to get one. And I used to make Motti queue for an hour outside the tuck shop while I read it at the front of the queue. And then I used to give him the paper. He was just mad on football. It was a rugby and we'd swap places. And, you know, these stories with Motti and I just went on and on throughout our lives, really. And it's a terrible loss. And, you know, it makes me think about my own mortality because I'm about, I was 4 months older than Motti. Yeah. So, you know, it comes home to roost and I just can't believe he's gone, really.
No, but I suppose fortunately for his family and for all the people like yourself that knew him, his voice will leave him in a sort of immortal place, won't it? Because you can always listen to the clips and you can watch the old games and his voice is there.
Well, where he's lucky, and I suppose I'm lucky on different programmes, is that we went through the old times right through to the modern times. So a lot of our work is still in libraries at the BBC and my channels that I was on. So, yeah, they get dug out from time to time, particularly football, where, you know, in the early days, these great players, we didn't have any footage of them. But in Motti's time, there's footage all over the place. So we're going to hear his voice lots and lots of times.
And like yourself, you know, there was no game too small, no game too big. You sort of did it all, right?
No, absolutely. I did 7 World Cups, as you say. Motti did all those matches. He was just a fanatic, really. He'd go to matches and pretend to commentate as well. I'd sit with him at games. You know, he was slightly off the wall, Motti. I think I'm more of a regular blue than Motti was. But Motti, he'd go into great slumps at meals and just look down. He had his own quirkisms, but he was a nice man. He was a good man. Mm. And he was a very famous man.
He was indeed. Gary, great to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed. Gary Newbon, MBE, who is, of course, an old friend of John Motson's and an old colleague of his as well. A very sad loss for the game of football, but what a remarkable legacy that he's left behind. Let's move now, though, to matters arising from other stories this morning in the papers, not least Lady Susan back at the palace, Lady Susan Hussey, that's in the Daily Mail today. Let's talk to Ella Whelan, columnist from Spikes, of course. Ella, very good morning to you.
Morning.
I don't know whether you've managed to stay awake long enough to listen to any of Keir Starmer's speech, but if you did, what did you make of his 5 missions?
Well, on the one hand, it's all pretty uncontroversial. You know, things like, you know, it's not going to blow anyone away having your 5 missions: education, the NHS, the economy. There's, you know, there's the kind of one of them is the environment, which is, you have to do that these days.
Yes.
You have to make a big sort of a deal about that. And, you know, there's already been some, I think, probably fair enough criticism of him. There's very few things I agree with momentum on, but they've called his speech vapid and said that his which, you know, I think is probably quite accurate.
Yeah.
He's trying to go down this route of saying, you know, again, this is what Keir Starmer and the current Labour Party, as it's been changed under him, does, which is they make a lot of they say a lot of things that sound very good. So, you know, they had this plan of extra democracy, and he used the take back control slogan. But then what it actually amounted to was this kind of sort of like devolution super plus plus, which wasn't very exciting at all. And a similar thing has happened today where he says, you know, I'm not going to do sticking plaster politics, but that's what he calls Westminster's kind of short-termism. Mm. We are unashamedly about having long-term plans. And you think, fantastic. This is, you know, was what lots of us have been saying for a very long time, that, for example, the economy can't be just fixed by handouts or by tinkering with tax. You have to have a long-term plan. But what is the long-term plan? Don't really know.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? I mean, that's the key question is, well, how are you going to make this happen? It's all very well. I mean, I always go back to Bill Clinton and his Make Poverty History campaign, which everybody agrees with, but never actually happened. And everybody goes, yeah, that's great. Yeah, make poverty history. Make sure that there's no poverty anywhere in the world. What a lovely aim. But then it didn't happen because you can't just do that magically. In the same way that Keir Starmer goes, let's make the streets safe. Well, I think everybody wants the streets to be safe. I don't think anybody would argue with that. But you can't just say it and then not tell us how you're going to do it.
Mm. And repeating, you know, Blair's slogan, tough on crime, tough on the causes of crime. And sort of he did it very self-consciously and said, ha, 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 you know, I know that you've heard that before. And there's, I mean, it's hard because in particular with Keir Starmer, he has been criticised time and time and time again by a range of people on the political spectrum for being sort of a kind of reheated Blair, by not being very original, not being very exciting, not trying to actually get to grips with some of the, you know, issues that don't relate to the 90s, that are very sort of 2023. And he just seems hell-bent on doing Blair 2.0, and it's not very inspiring. And it's, you know, there are some, you know, in terms of his credibility, I mean, I was listening to a radio interview with him this morning, in which the interviewer quite rightly pointed out that, for example,
a lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Example. He, you know, rode off of the back of Corbynism, you know, and made hay while the sun shined on the Labour Party at that time, when there was a lot of support, promised things like the nationalisation of energy and water and things like that, and has now completely reneged on it. And he sort of, his answer to that is, oh, different times.
Yes.
But that's not a sufficient answer as to why you have changed your political principles.
And also, he couldn't really, I was going to say, the two things that sort of dog him and Labour is he couldn't really answer the question, you know, why were you so enthusiastically supportive of Jeremy Corbyn's wish to become Prime Minister, knowing what you say you know about him and how you've now stopped him from running as a Labour candidate at the next election. And the other one, which I know is close to your heart, Ella, is the issue of what is a woman, you know, because even now, still, and I was saying this to Peter Cardwell, you know, shadow ministers in the Labour Party on the front bench still struggle to actually give you an answer when you say, you know, what is a woman and what is a trans woman?
And I think all of that comes down to the fact that the Labour Party certainly has changed, and the way it's changed is that it's become representative of and desiring to speak to a much narrower section of society. So not the labouring classes, you know very well what a woman is, what a man is.
Yeah.
But really they're speaking to, you know, in particular, actually his sort of promise of net zero by 2030 is in line with this. Speaking to, you know, his constituency, basically, a very narrow middle class section of metropolitan society, you know, in kind of big cities, Londoners and people in Manchester who think all this stuff is really great and right on, and a sort of Labour in a sort of lazy way. But in actual fact, the sort of the key things, you know, that are, you know, if he knew anything about what the average working class family is facing in terms of, you know, not just energy bills right now, but sort of everything under the cost of living crisis, what we don't want to hear is that you're going to narrow our choices for energy production in the next 7 years, which is part of the net zero 2030 promise. So it's, you know, the Labour Party has long been moving towards being a party of the middle class, and I think it's firmly there. And so all of his pronouncements about being, you know, the party of the people and taking back control, I think probably most people are a little bit smirking and scornful of that at the moment.
Yeah, absolutely right. Finally, just a mention of this story, because I thought it was quite an interesting one in the Mail today. Lady Susan Hussey, who was sort of fired rather unceremonially, rather quickly, because of an accusation that was made about her being a racist, apparently is back working at Buckingham Palace.
Yeah, as the reports go, went in through the staff entrance and, you know, is being backed by Princess Anne. And, you know, I can't count how many rifts there are now within the royal family, but certainly the treatment of Lady Hussey, whatever you think, I mean, even someone like me who can, you know, give a monkey's about what goes on with the royal family, could understand that was handled pretty poorly.
Yes.
And that in terms of, you know, so, for abstract values like loyalty or duty or, you know, solidarity, if that exists within the monarchy, she was treated pretty badly. I mean, you know, if I was her, I would have put up her kitten heels and her nude tights and said, all right, stuff you, I'm going to enjoy the last years of my life, yeah. you know, drinking tea in front of the telly. But if she wants to go back, she wants to go back and let it be, you know, her own self-flagellation.
Well, it does show, doesn't it, though, that some of these things can be so ridiculously kind of storms in teacups and knee-jerk reactions all over the place. And, you know, we must get rid of these people.
There is a really interesting thing that there's this current problem for the royal family where they are constantly being embarrassed by themselves. So that, well, you know, another interesting sort of row, which is semi-related to all of this, is whether or not, you know, it's now been decided that she won't, whether or not Camilla was going to wear the Kohinoor diamond in her crown because of the whole sort of tensions around race relations with that. And, you know, if the royal family can't stand up for its own traditions and can't be confident in its own traditions, you know, even those of us like me, again, who don't respect or are interested in those traditions because I'm a Republican, I mean, you should be able to stand up for what you believe in and what defines you. Otherwise, my side of the argument starts to win because we start to say, well, what's the point in you?
Yeah, right. No, I think that's a very good point to make. Ella, great to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed. Ella Whelan, Spiked columnist there on the news about the latest from the royal family, which is that Lady Susan Hussey appears to have been reemployed at Buckingham Palace after that storm in a teacup where she was forced to sort of take her marching orders because she'd asked the question of somebody who was there who said that she felt that she was put upon and she felt like she was the subject of racism. It's all gone a bit quiet on that side of the pond, of course, hasn't it? 0344 499 1000 is the number. Coming up, we'll talk to John McTiernan, former advisor to Tony Blair, to see what he makes of Sir Keir Starmer's five missions.
Online on DAB+, Talk Radio and Talk TV.
Welcome back to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk TV. We've got Sir Keir Starmer's five missions. We'll tell you what those are in a moment. But how about this from Sarah in West Sussex? Hi, Mike. In contrast to Sunak's speech, when he set out his five pledges, the speech included how these would be achieved. Starmer's five missions, Rolls Eyes, include nothing about how these would be achieved. These missions are platitudes. Growth is what's needed, not a bigger state. Cooper's policy set out recently effectively added more bottoms on seats, a veritable clipboard warriors. Let's never forget, there is no money. Good luck. Well, basically, the five missions are to secure growth in the G7 to make it the highest in that particular area, make Britain a clean energy superpower, build an NHS fit for the future, make Britain's streets safe, break down the barriers to opportunity at every stage. Rapturous applause up there in Manchester where Sir Keir was speaking. But let's talk now to John McTiernan, former advisor to Tony Blair. Tony Blair was back in the news only yesterday, punting this idea of digital ID cards with William Hague. John, a very good morning to you.
Good morning.
Thanks very much indeed for joining us. I mean, it's all quite nice. Some people expressing surprise that there was no mention of immigration in the five missions, particularly since today is a day when we've seen new policy coming from the government on fast-tracking asylum-seeking applications, but also new immigration statistics showing a larger number of people coming last year than the year before by a number of something like 60,000. So what did you make of it? Was it a bit vague for you?
No, I think it's a really good programme. It's a really good, you know, as he says, Keir Starmer says, it's a vision, it's a mission. It's what a Labour government would be driven by to achieve. And I think if we achieve those five things, this would be a much, much better country. And he's absolutely right that we currently have a government who are not focused on big strategy. They're just focused on small things that are going to happen anyway, like halving inflation, that's happening, or trying to claim that they can control things they can't control, like stopping the boats, which they've got, don't have the competence to stop the boats. So, yeah, look, I think this is...
Yeah, but I think if there's going to be any conversation around an election, Starmer's going to have some policy about stopping the boats because people want the boats stopped.
Yeah, but Labour's got a plan for stopping the boats. Which is if you actually allow legal routes to come to Britain, then you will stop people getting into boats and risking their lives.
I don't think that will work, though.
The fact is that the government have prevented people who have a connection to this country coming to this country by denying them any legal route of getting here, leaving the disgrace where, you know, Afghan people who worked with our troops, worked with our government in Afghanistan, are not safe there and have no route to come to the UK, being betrayed.
But that's a very small number, John, as you know. That's a tiny number of people who are coming. And not everybody who's coming on the small boats is coming because they've got family members here. It's a business, right? There's an awful lot of people making an awful lot of money, both on the French side and on the British side. You know, so there's whenever there's a lot of money to be made, that's going to continue.
We'd stop in a heartbeat if we had legal routes to come to the UK.
I don't think you would.
If we had processing of applications in France, but the Keir speech was excellent, and it shows you he and his team are ready for government and the current.
Well, you say it's excellent, but you would say that, John, wouldn't you? But I mean, you know, you've been a recent convert to Keir Starmer. The problem he's got, he was questioned this morning on another radio station. He couldn't answer the question that was put to him. Why were you such an enthusiastic supporter of Jeremy Corbyn when he wanted to be Prime Minister, and now you've basically thrown him under a bus? What's changed? Because he knew all the things he knew about Jeremy Corbyn when he was in his cabinet.
Jeremy Corbyn refused to accept the judgment of the EHRC on the Labour Party, and for that, he was chucked out of the Parliamentary Labour Party, and because of that, he's not going to be able to stand to
be
an MP.
Yes, we know all that. But that was put to Keir Starmer.
We can judge Keir by his actions. He's actually making sure that that man cannot stand as a Labour MP.
Yes, I understand that, John. But the question that he was asked that he did not answer, which he cannot answer, is why was he such an enthusiastic supporter of a man who he now says was anti-Semitic, effectively?
He's saying the man failed in the duty as leader of the Labour Party. The public made their judgment on Corbyn's Labour Party in 2019 when we got thrashed. Keir made his judgment on Jeremy Corbyn when he prevented him from being a member of the Parliament.
Let me put it to you another way.
And the public are making a clear judgment.
Let me put it to you another way, John.
Giving us a 25-point lead.
Let me give you another opportunity to answer the question, which you're also not answering. Should he not have been more, hard line then with Jeremy Corbyn rather than supporting him for being the next Prime Minister, which is what he did? You know, he didn't question Jeremy Corbyn when he was underneath him. He only threw him under a bus when he was leader.
When you're the leader of the Labour Party, you can deal with MPs. And he did. He dealt with them really
rapidly. Yeah, but I'm talking about when he was in Jeremy Corbyn's team.
Everybody knows that Keir Starmer is stopping Jeremy Corbyn being a member.
You're not answering the question, are you? You just don't want to answer it. If you don't want to answer it, just tell me.
I don't mind that the public understand that Keir Starmer has chucked Jeremy Corbyn out of the Parliamentary Party and is stopping any opportunity from being a member of Parliament.
All right, let me ask you a direct question, and I'll give you one more chance, John. Do you personally think that Keir Starmer was wrong to support Jeremy Corbyn as much as he did when he was running to be Prime Minister?
I think Keir Starmer was right to want a Labour government to replace the Tory government in the 2019 general election. And I think the record of Boris Johnson has proved that even the Tory party didn't want Boris Johnson as Prime Minister. So we were right to not want this disastrous Tory government who are just wrecking the country. And Keir is right to chuck out Jeremy Corbyn.
And you know Keir quite well. Does he regret his friendship with Jeremy Corbyn?
Keir's a politician. He's the leader of the party.
So he doesn't. So he'll just basically be friends with anyone if it gets him into power. Is that what you're saying?
Keir will do what the British people want to make this great country a great country again. That's what drives him as a politician. That's why he's got missions to transform the country. That's why he ran for leadership. And that's why he's going to make a great Prime Minister.
He's saying he wants to make Britain great again.
He wants to make Britain greater than it has ever been.
Sounds a bit Trumpian, that.
There's nothing wrong with being great.
Yeah, Great Britain is always great, though. It's not great.
It's been our... It's, look, this great country of ours is being held back by the current government. The disaster in the National Health Service, that is the consequence of this government. Nobody can be proud of our NHS and the state it is at the moment. That is the consequence of this government. You know, the government has got to take responsibility for their 12 years of underfunding, the cuts to the police. You know, the things that Keir is talking about that have to be transformed. They've got to be transformed because our country is in a terrible, terrible state at the moment.
Yes, I agree with you, and I think most people agree with you, but the problem is that we're not seeing any answers from Keir Starmer, we're just hearing platitudes. I've got this from Charlotte. Starmer is talking like a 1980s beauty queen. I will spend my time solving world hunger and creating global peace. Not remotely achievable, just word salad. Where are the how and when details? Where are the policies? And I think that's a fair question, isn't it?
There's a detailed document being issued this morning. People can read that on the Labour Party website, and there is going to be a year and a half, 18 months to 2 years until the next general election. And over that period, you're going to get more details from Keir about how we are going to deliver what we're going to deliver. And everything, every promise is going to be thought through and costed. And that's the right thing to do. But we are sadly at least 18 months and probably 2 years from the next general
election. Well, Lisa and Andy seem to think it might be next May.
Look, let's hope. I think we have to hope it's next May. It'd be ideal if it was actually this June, to be honest. The sooner we're shot of this mob, the better.
Well, we shall see. Then we can have a real go at you. That'll be really,
yeah,
that'll
exactly.
Be great. That'll be great fun. We'll see you soon. John, thank you very much indeed. John McTiernan, former advisor to Tony Blair. He thinks there should be an election now. I mean, listen, I said there should have been an election back end of the summer. That's when I wanted it. I'd love to see Keir Starmer trying to fix the problems of this country, because I don't think he could. I don't think he could fix his own shoe. This is Talk TV.
Edgy talk, plain talk, unrivaled talk. Mike Graham. The only radio show you can count on for a proper serving of good old-fashioned common sense. In search of the perfect debate.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham.
On your mobile, on your wavelength, Talk Radio and Talk TV.
Welcome back to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk TV. Loads going on, by the way. It's been an incredibly busy show. We've had Sir Keir Starmer, luckily not for too long because it wasn't very exciting. We're going to be talking this afternoon to our reporter who's outside the Bank of England because he's going to be telling us why they think they should put interest rates up even more. So we haven't had enough punishment yet, so that is still to come. Also, we've got the Thursday Club, of course. Helen Nicola will be popping in, and I think she's got some Cabernet Sauvignon for us today. Not quite sure why, but she's always got a good reason for drinking, and so have I, quite frankly. Right now, though, we've been talking about John Motson. We were just talking to Jim White. We talked to Alan McCoy this morning. Another legendary figure has entered the studio. He is Paul Hawksby from Hawksby & Jacobs. Paul, very good afternoon
to
you.
Hi, Mike.
John Motson, a man who everybody in our business knew pretty well, I think, because he'd been around for that long, that at some point or other, almost everybody probably met him. You worked with him as well.
Yeah.
An amazing figure, really, wasn't he? He just kind of, when you see the number of World Cups that he covered, the number of cup finals, I'm looking at clips on TV of various goals, like the Ricky Villa goal.
Sure.
And it sort of takes you back, doesn't it, to your youth. Well, in my case, not that young, but you know, it takes you back to the moment you were watching it, the missed penalties, you know,
yeah,
the anguish of the managers, the fans. It's almost like he's a one-man sort of history machine.
Yeah, we were lucky to work with myself and Andy. We were approached here. Motty, when he retired from commentary on the Beeb, he was approached by TalkSport to come in on a Monday and a Friday,
right,
and we would look back on the weekend,
yes,
and look ahead.
Yes, I remember listening to that, yeah.
And we'd get together a couple, and they were real kind of pinch-yourself moments. Remember the first couple? But myself and Andy knew Motty.
Yeah.
He was a massive racing fan as
was
well.
Was he? Yeah.
Used to see him at Cheltenham every year, and with his great friend Gary Newbon, who was an old school friend.
Yes, we spoke to Gary earlier, yeah.
Amazing. And we used to meet Motty a couple of times a week. There was that same attention to detail. It was lovely to be part of this kind of second act, this couple of seasons, when he wanted to keep active.
And he was sort of encyclopedic with his knowledge as well, wasn't he?
He
like
was.
Like a lot of those kind of guys.
I mean, he would soak all this stuff up by osmosis, but we saw, Andy and I, the preparation. He put an awful lot of prep into it. He'd never want to come on air and be underprepared.
Yes.
But, I mean...
Yeah, Jim said he recalled a story where he would love nothing more than to watch some very sort of... incredibly difficult cup tie for a team of sort of amateurs, and there'd be a guy who was a postman. He loved that, and he would say, you know, he's delivered a great cross, you know, all that kind of thing. Just really clever, you know.
He told me that he never rehearsed those lines, you know, crazy gang, culture club. He said
just came off with that. I like that though, because I think you can script things a bit too much, can't you? I mean, we all sit around and plan shows and do TV and radio and all the rest of it, but I always find the most kind of enjoyable stuff is the off-the-cuff kind of unprepared things.
Yeah, yeah.
It always sounds better, doesn't it?
Yeah, he was. I mean, and he kind of spanned a generation. I mean, there was no real co-commentators when he first started off. And for the first 6 years of his career, really, after the famous Ronnie Radford goal, that was his sliding doors moment. Yes. It was a nothing game that Newcastle was supposed to win easily. Mm. They didn't, and that was huge for Matty. But he only ever did highlights. It wasn't until the 1977 FA Cup that he did his first live game. Right. Hard to believe, isn't it?
It is amazing, isn't it? Because how do you prepare for that, I wonder?
Yeah.
You know, your first actual
he said he
live
was incredible. I remember
because it's one of those things that, you know, as you say, they now have a sort of commentator and a co-commentator who does a sort of colour and all that sort of thing. And as much as I can talk for Britain, I don't think I could ever get anywhere near a commentating job. There's no chance. It's a bit like I once was asked to read the news, and it was so bad. People were going, why is Michael Caine reading the news? Because there is an art to it, and the same with
commentators. And that period that went from just the commentator to the co-commentator, you had people like Trevor Brooking, Mark Lawrence, and Graham Lasso. He worked with Bobby Charlton.
Right.
But then that role changed. Co-commentators had a lot more to say. And he told me a story once about Jimmy Hill. Mm. And when they used to have one microphone. So it wasn't two mics, one for the co-commentator, one for... So once Jimmy got the microphone off him, you couldn't get it off him again.
I remember hearing him telling that story.
Fighting stuff. Over the mic.
Brilliant. You're on this afternoon once again.
We are.
1 o'clock.
Andy and I have got some really great memories of him. I think a celebration of a brilliant career and an amazing life, really. Yes. So we'll bring on some people to the show to sort of talk about their memories of him. But I think, you know, I kind of think of him with a smile, really. So we'll tell a few Motty War stories.
He is like an awful lot of those people. Nobody's got anything bad to say about him. Everybody's got good things to say. Paul, thank you very much indeed. Hawksby and Jacobs coming up at 1 o'clock right here on TalkSport. The same network. There's all sorts of things going on. We'll be talking to Henry Bolton very shortly. But John Motson, a man that everybody really does remember, whether or not you actually did have a problem watching football, whether you listened to his voice on the radio, he was just a man that sort of covered pretty much every single important event in football over the past 50 years for the BBC, when it used to be good, of course. Henry Bolton is here. Very good afternoon to you, Henry.
Hello.
You probably weren't expecting me to ask you about John Motson, but I mean, I don't know if you're a football fan, but he was one of those great Britons, wasn't he?
He was. And no, I'm not a football fan, Mike, but he was one of the voices that I sort of grew up with, really. Yeah. And I hadn't sort of, to be fair, I'd forgotten all about him, but the idea that he's not there anymore is a little bit of a...
Well, he retired from the BBC a few years ago, but he ended up working here, and he was in this building for a while working for TalkSport. So fascinating character. But let's talk about the business at hand. The big story for me this morning, two of them really, the new Home Office statistics that came out this morning just before the show started. The asylum backlog has now hit 160,919.
It has indeed.
And it's already probably over that because that was in December 2022. Mm-hmm. Number of claimants awaiting the outcome of cases has risen by 60,000 in the space of a year. 97% of small boat asylum applications are awaiting a decision. 83% of asylum cases since 2018 are awaiting a decision. I mean, the numbers are prodigious, aren't they? I mean, anything worse than these asylum cases waiting to be heard are NHS waiting list numbers, you know, which is nothing to be proud of, it has to be said. And then, of course, this morning we have this other ridiculous idea from Rishi Sunak's department in which they say, oh, don't worry, we're going to solve all this. We're going to start basically handing asylum to people by giving them a questionnaire, which almost certainly they'll have filled out by somebody from a charity or from a legal office. Yeah. They'll get the asylum. They'll then invite two or three members of their family to come, and suddenly we'll have another 50,000 people here.
Indeed. No, I mean, what we're seeing in these figures, they're always getting bigger.
Yeah.
There is nothing reducing them. There is no government strategy. And fine, you know, I'm very pleased that the Prime Minister has promised to stop the small boats. But legislation, as he's promised, you know, he's going to enact to do that, isn't going to do it itself. What you have to have is the people, the structures, the resources on the ground to use that terrible word, operationalise this, to enforce, to enact, to actually operationally enact those laws. The law in itself will do nothing. And what we're seeing here with these numbers is a failure of the structures. It's a failure in process, it's a failure in systems, and it's a failure in resources. Mm. And if the government's not going to address those, then these numbers are going to continue to grow. It doesn't matter how many promises anybody makes.
Yeah. And are you surprised? I suspect the answer is no, that Sir Keir Starmer, in his mission speech, where he said he's got five missions that he wants to make the world a better place, and as somebody said, he's talking like a beauty queen from the 1980s, you know, want to eradicate world poverty. He didn't mention immigration at all.
No, he didn't, no.
Extraordinary.
Well, given the politics within the Labour Party, it's not extraordinary. Mm. He's got to cater for that as well. He's talking to two audiences, remember. He's talking to the people he wants to vote for Labour in the next general election. And he's also talking to his own party.
Yeah.
And he's got to keep both on board. Well, he's got to get one on board and keep the other one on board. And so he's treading a difficult path. I've had to do that in another party, and it's not an easy job. Mm. And you want to say something, but you can't. And, you know, let's face it, his character is such that he doesn't want to engage robustly with this problem. So on the one hand, we've got a party, the Labour Party, who is not going to engage robustly on dealing with this. And on the other hand, we've got a party that doesn't know how to. Mm. It might want to. The Prime Minister might want to. Suella Braverman might want to. But the government, and I include the civil service there, either don't know how to do it, and when it comes to the civil service, are institutionally sort of kind of find it very, it goes against the grain for them.
Julie Hartley Brewer was saying this morning that there was a piece, I think Guido published yesterday, in which they had found the kind of mission statement for the Home Office for the next 12 months. Doesn't mention immigration.
Yeah,
there's nothing in
that's
there.
That's right. It's
which
not,
takes
not
care
even
of,
in the top three priorities not, no. for the civil service.
I mean,
and
if,
home
it's,
office.
If it's not so, a priority for the Home Office, then how on earth is Downing Street going to get anything done?
Well, they're not. And this is the problem that ministers have. And I'm going to be fair to Suella Braverman. I think she is a good woman with a good intent, and she's got the will. Mm. What she's not got is the experience and the knowledge to actually drive that incredibly difficult government department to deliver.
Yes.
She might say, I want to do this. And they say, well, Minister, it's not so easy. And if the Minister then doesn't have the knowledge to be able to say, no, it's easy enough. We've got to do this, and this.
But
and
one of the things that was said about her, one of the things that was said about her when she got the job was that she had worked as a lawyer inside the Home Office, so she knew the business inside out, and that was why she was going to be better than Priti Patel. But it seems to me that everybody who walks in the door sort of immediately gets stuck in the quicksand of whatever is behind the door, and they can't do anything.
Well, one of the things, they get captured by the system. So, I mean, if we've got a moment, I'll describe the sort of kind of, rather theatrically, how it works. So a minister becomes Secretary of State. They take over a government department. They arrive, probably quite early in the morning, and their senior civil service team is there with the diary and so on, and say, right, Minister, OK, on your diary, on your radar should be, you've got a meeting this afternoon with X, Y and Z. You know, then you've got to do X, Y and Z. Then you've got a media interview. Then you've got, and tomorrow there's this, and this. And for the next couple of weeks. At that point, ministers need to say, no, stop. Mm. This is the agenda that we're going to enact. You're going to need to cancel that meeting or bloody well justify to me why it's so necessary.
Yeah.
Because the moment you have that meeting, let's say it's with, I don't know, a foreign ambassador, and you have a diplomatic conversation over a cup of tea, and the ambassador asks you for something and says, well, can you help out with this? And you say, well, OK, we'll look into that. And then all of a sudden, you've got to have follow-up.
Yeah.
And your agenda, your diary is then driven by all of that mess rather than what you're there to do.
Yes.
Now, I know that sounds, you know, crazy, but that's the situation. Yeah. That's how it works. And you've got one person in there who doesn't have the power to hire and fire the staff around her.
Yeah.
One person in there who has got to drive the entire machinery of a government department that doesn't really want to be driven.
Mm.
It's very difficult.
It's the tail wagging the dog at the end of the day because people would assume, it's like a lot of businesses, I suppose, that you go in as the boss, you change everything. But it sounds good, but it's not really that easy.
It's not that easy in running a government ministry.
Hope have we got then as individuals who live in this country and who want this all to stop?
Well, you know, somehow, I mean, you know, working in international missions, when in the United Nations it's particularly difficult, and sometimes you get a high representative of the Secretary General of the UN in there who actually knows how to deal with it. And what they do is they say, look, I'm going to bring in a team from outside. I don't give a damn. They are going to drive this.
Yeah.
All right. They're going to be properly integrated into the chain, but they're going to drive it. They know what they're doing. And if you can't deliver it, they will.
Yeah.
But
where the consultants come in, and that's where the £3,000 a day goes.
Well, that's the other problem then, is that then we've got this system here in this in London, in down the road here, where we've got a culture of paying people hugely, disgusting amounts of money for this. Yes, it's a responsible job, but at the end of the day, what was it, £7,000 a day for some of the consultants weren't working on COVID?
Yeah.
Big, serious issue. But this is the taxpayer footing this, and we should be having people in there who want to do this because it's important to deliver positive results.
And at the end of the day,
money.
I think for me anyway, the only way to stop the boat crossings is to make Britain, and I don't mean this in a cruel way, a less friendly environment. If you come here illegally, you should not be guaranteed a place to live. You should not be guaranteed, you know, clothing, food, anything. Because if you come here illegally, you're an illegal immigrant.
If you want to
surely.
If you want to stop people going somewhere, then you would make that place an unattractive destination.
Yeah, right.
People don't want to go on holiday to places that where the food's bad, where the housing's bad, where, you know, everything's useless, terrible, but hugely expensive.
And
they won't, and there's no sun. They won't, and dangerous, and they won't go.
Right.
If this, if the UK opens up our arms to people, makes it very easy for them to come here, very easy to live here, it's all comfortable for them, then fine, they will come.
Yeah.
If as long as we're a nice place to
and they won't stop coming.
And they won't. But the other thing is, you know, we've got this idea of, now as you alluded to earlier, Mike, where the government now is going to fast track 12,000 asylum claims from I think 5 countries on the assumption that anyway they'd grant 95%. But let me tell you now, Mike, and anybody who's listening, and anybody in government, what will happen now is that the people smugglers will use that as a marketing tool, whether true or not. They will now say to the people they want to bring into their business, their customers, the economic migrants, they will say, all you have to do is fill out a 10-page form, and you know what? Actually, the charities in the UK will do it.
Well, that's
and then
how to do it,
you won't even have to do an interview.
Right.
And whether that actually is reality in a year's time or so, now it's been out there, it's government policy, it's what they're going to do, it will be used as a marketing tool.
Yes, it'll be the next TikTok advert, won't it?
Exactly.
Unbelievable. Henry, good to see you. Thank you very much indeed. Henry Bolton, of course, chairman of BritPac, international borders expert as well. I wish we had some of those in the government. That would be good, would it not? Coming up, though, we're going over to the Bank of England because it looks like the powers that be on the money side of things want to put your interest rates up even more. This is TalkTV.
Across the UK, online and on DAB, the Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
So if you enjoyed that, be sure to catch the whole show 10 to 1, Monday to Friday on Talk Radio, via DAB, online or via the Talk Radio app. If you have an opinion on the stories we cover, we'd love to hear from you. Call us 0344 499 1000 or tweet at Talk Radio during the show to have your say.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.